Five, four, three, two, one.
Evil dies tonight.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Now Shining Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Sam Hoos, and I'm joined today by my wonderful co-host, Lewis.
Lewis is a ghost.
Lewis is a ghost. Yeah. I'm actually being joined by my wonderful ex-co-host, Jordan Lee McDonald, who is stepping in because today is our late Halloween special. Now, anyone who knows the podcast knows that Lewis does not do horror, so I couldn't get him in, so I had to call up the former co-host of the Now Show podcast, Jordan Lee McDonald. So, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very good. Happy Halloween. Late Halloween, everyone.
Late Halloween, yeah.
Yeah, it's nice to be back for some... Talk about some horror films, Halloween ends and such.
Exactly, and as he's just alluded to, we are doing Halloween Ends as our main film today. We'll be talking about a few Halloween-y things otherwise, but we are looking at primarily Halloween Ends, which is the culmination of David Gordon Green's Halloween reboot trilogy that started with 2018's Halloween and continued with the less memorable Halloween Kills, and now is ending with Halloween Ends, of course, reboots of John Carpenter's legendary Halloween franchise from 1977. And all those films, of course, star Jamie Lee Curtis in the main role as she faces off against Michael Myers. But yeah, so it's spooky season, of course. Actually, it's kind of ending spooky season. We're already getting into Christmas season with films. I'm seeing people on Twitter talking about which Christmas films to start getting into. I personally think that's quite a ridiculous... That's quite early, right? Like, surely we need a bit of a break. There's got to be something between.
Yeah. I mean, the big debate I've seen on Twitter this week is... Well, not even a debate, really, but people talk about how The Batman is a Halloween film.
Oh, The Batman is a Halloween film, of course. If we're counting Die Hard as a Christmas film, yeah. The Batman is a Halloween film, mm-hmm. 100%. It's the Die Hard of Halloween films.
Yeah.
But he's a lot better than Die Hard. I saw The Batman with you, of course, our bougie premiere. And did you see The Batman? I mean, a bit of a tangent, of course. But did you see The Batman again? Because I remember when we saw it together, you had by far the most negative opinions of me, you, and Lewis. And you did say, oh, I'll have to watch, give it a rewatch, see if I kind of... My opinion's changed. Did you have a rewatch?
Yeah, I've watched it again, yeah. It definitely worked more on a rewatch. And I think even, like, it's one of those films where the more I've thought about it as time's gone on, the more I've kind of loved it and, like, sort of been thinking about it. I've still got, like, a few issues with it as a film, but I think definitely one of those films where it's kind of grown. And even though I haven't really rewatched it since I watched it in the cinema, that first rewatch, it's just a film I think about quite often.
Only film I've ever seen in the cinema 3 times.
Really?
Fun fact. Yes, yeah.
I thought you saw Tenet 3 times.
No, I saw Tenet twice. I think you saw Tenet 3 times.
Yeah, 3 or 4, yeah.
A bit of a clarification, guys, for any regular listeners. Today is the start of a podcast week, a week of entertainment for you lot, because you're going to be getting 3 podcasts this week opposed to your usual 1 a month. So this may be coming out on November the 1st, but this actually is the second podcast we've recorded. We recorded an episode a few days ago, which is looking at a few October highlights. So The Woman King, Black Adam and Smile, and Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris. That was recorded earlier, but it's been released later because of scheduling problems. So when we talk about news, what we've watched, I'm not going to be talking about stuff that I've already talked about there. And in that episode, I'm going to be talking about, I'm going to be foreshadowing this and talking about the upcoming Halloween special. Obviously, things got swapped around. So, you know, even though they've been recorded out of order, but we're going to have these two. So you've got that to look forward to. And then in around a week's time, you should be getting the first episode of our retrospectives on Doctor Who, because Lewis has been going through Doctor Who for the first time. And lying in TikTok and pretending that I'm not there and talking to him. So, you know, I'm just saying I deserve a bit of his TikTok fame. I'm not getting any of it, but whatever. That explains why I'm not going to be talking about certain films that I've watched in the What We've Watched section, which is my segue into it. Because, as I mentioned in that episode, I say when I'm talking about, when I'm doing my What We've Watched on that one, I talk about how I'm not going to review the horror films I watched in the horror marathon, but I'm going to do it now. So on the night of the 22nd into the 23rd, I attended an all-night movie marathon at the Prince Charles Cinema. Shout out to the Prince Charles Cinema, perhaps the best cinema in the country, perhaps the best cinema I've ever been to. And the all-night horror marathon consisted of five films, which were The Exorcist, The Thing, The Shining, Suspiria, the 1977 one, and the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Of those five films, I had previously seen The Exorcist and The Shining, so three of them were new to me. And I'm just going to give my thoughts on all of them now, perhaps a little bit more extended than I usually would in what we've watched, but these are horror films and the horror specials. I think it is valid. So, to start off, The Exorcist, which was actually, funny enough, the first film I watched in 2022. So it's a rewatch. Seeing it on the big screen was, as I expected, a pleasure. Have you seen The Exorcist, Lewis? Lewis, Jordan, sorry.
I think we were going to do it for an episode. And then I started watching it, and then I had to stop watching it like part like 5-10 minutes into the film, and then we never actually covered it on the podcast, so I never actually watched
it. No, we did Nightmare on Elm Street, didn't we? Which you did not like.
No.
Yeah. Yes. So The Exorcist. Yeah. First time I watched the year, watching it again. Of course, William Friedkin's most well known work from the William Pitt Blatty novel. A wonderful look. I mean, absolutely terrifying even today. You know, how it's probably the most Christian horror film you'll ever see. Looking at kind of the role of the Catholic Church and how evil corrupts and the devil himself and all this stuff. Yeah, wonderful score, wonderfully shot. You know, one of the best horror films of all time. The only thing I have a problem with is that I saw it on 35mm, which is, of course, you know, a massive, a privilege. However, it was advertised that it was the director's cut, but then in reality they actually played the theatrical cut. And if you've ever seen the kind of clip, which is kind of more, you know, super famous, I imagine you've probably seen anyway, of the main character, Regan, going backwards down the stairs while she's possessed, that is only in the director's cut. And that was cut from, and one of the most egregious decisions ever. I think it was something to do with the fact that you could see the wires. But yeah, that a few really great scenes in the director's cut that don't make it to the theatrical version, and that really hurt not being able to see them, knowing that we're missing out on some really interesting dialogue between the two exorcists, and also seeing the missing the Regan, that scene, you know, hurt a little bit. So now I'm going to come into your what we watched as well here, because the second film was The Thing, the John Carpenter film from 1982, not the original. I'd never seen The Thing before. It was one of the, I think it's the highest rated horror film on Letterboxd, so I've been very excited to see it for a long time. And obviously, it's kind of one of those films where you almost feel like, yeah, I had seen it because of how much I know about it and how much you see it around without actually having watched it. But you also watched it this week, I believe. So if you wanted to give your lead off, I'm assuming this is the first time you've seen it, right?
Yeah. So I watched it last night on Halloween night for the first time in the cinema, and it's definitely one, like I said, like the highest rated horror film. It's definitely got its massive reputation around it, and I really enjoyed it. I thought like it's one of those films where I think I've said this before as well on the podcast, where it's one of those such highly rated films that like I went into it with massive expectations, and I wasn't like. I really did love it, but like the things I really enjoyed about it the most, I wanted more of. I was like, I want more of the like the mystery and the suspense and like trying to piece together the kind of mystery aspect of, you know, who's like contaminated, who's been like compromised. I think like it definitely has like comparisons, and I'm sure you'll draw on this to, like, compared to like The Shining in terms of like very psychological, but I think like the practical effects in that film are amazing. And I kind of wanted to be more of a psychological thing. And I think it had a good balance in terms of like the psychological horror and the actual, you know, practical effects and visual stuff. But I think I wanted it to be more of a psychological horror than it was. But yeah, the score, some of like the like cinematography and stuff, and like the practical effects were amazing. And like I say, like the tension and stuff was awesome. So it was like a case of wanting more of the stuff I really enjoyed, but it was definitely a great film, and I can see why it's got the reputation it does.
Yeah. I mean, I think So if anyone hasn't seen The Thing, unaware of The Thing, basically it's centered around a kind of science base in Antarctica, and kind of mysterious alien virus kind of arrives in the camp and starts kind of taking over people, and they kind of have to work out who is being possessed by the alien, who is being taken over by the alien, who's real. But yeah, I mean, I think the comparison you say with The Shining, the comparison I was going to make will be with the film from Ridley Scott, Alien, which is one of my favorite horror films ever. And I think them two both share the same wonderful aspect of isolationism, and that's the kind of thing that I think really drew me into The Thing more than anything. I think the whodunit nature was definitely very interesting. I kind of agree. I almost wish they put a little bit more upon that. And I think, you know, the visual effects, the alien horror, the body horror was wonderful. And actually, I think the body horror is quite similar in an aspect to Alien. You know, the kind of male pregnancy section you have in Alien can be kind of compared to some of the kind of ways that bodies ripped apart by aliens appearing in this. But yeah, the real thing that stood out to me is just the wonderful way that the isolationism is created, and the kind of feeling of kind of loneliness out there in the ice, back kind of just when they're just the way that the camp is presented from the get-go, and how, you know, you can feel that the outside world being a million miles away, the way their responsibilities are described, the way that really sets in how far they are from society, but also when it comes to fighting off the alien, how isolated the individuals feel against this kind of outside pressure. I thought, you know, that was really what kind of drew the horror for me, and I think that's kind of one of my favorite things if it's done well in horror. And of course, that lays into the next film, which is also about isolation to a degree, which is The Shining. Now, The Shining, a rewatch, I've seen this a fair few times in the last year or two. When I reviewed it, my biggest regret on the podcast, I have very little regrets on the podcast over the last two and a bit years. One of the only regrets I have is my review of The Shining, which was the fourth episode we did, me, you, and your friend Johnny. I have a strong amount of regret that exists, and I almost feel tempted to delete it because I feel so embarrassed about how not over the moon I was about probably my favorite horror film of all time. Now, every time I've rewatched it, it's kind of developed more as just how much I love it. I think that, you know, going from that when I was in there, I think I just cannot believe that I was insulting, that I criticized the performance of Shelley Duvall. When watching this back, I think she might be the best performance in a horror film ever. I cannot believe that I was so naive to it at that point, but, you know, I have to accept. This is the first time I've seen it at the cinema. First time I've seen it on film. Truly beautiful. I mean, that's probably the above all else, above the horror, above the performances, above the wonderful dialogue, above anything, symbolism, everything. Just the main thing for me is just how wonderful it's shot. You know, the Steadicam, the symmetry, the colours. I mean, it's just an absolutely beautiful film. This is the first time that I've seen the British version. The first two times I saw the US version. And it actually makes for a very different film, I feel, like the choice of scenes. It actually very much redefined a lot of the things around The Shining itself, and other kind of aspects of the film. The fact that, for example, a very small detail that's in the US version that's not in the version I saw was discussing Jack Nicholson's character Jack's history with drink. That is completely missing from the version I watched, and that was very interesting that it kind of didn't have that definition to his character. But anyway, wonderful. I mean, I think, you know, again, this is the story, if anyone is unaware, it's a story about Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall, are parents of a young boy played by Danny Lloyd. They go to this Overlook Hotel in the middle of nowhere to kind of caretake it over the winter months. It's just them three there. Very early on, it's established that the young boy Danny has some sort of supernatural power. He can kind of he can have conversations with other people that have The Shining. He can have conversations with the kind of voices in his head. He can see flashbacks to the past other people can't see. He kind of is this kind of vague supernatural power that is, you know, I think, honestly, I think very well explained and very well looked at in the sequel, Doctor Sleep. But it's a little bit more undefined here. But whilst he's experiencing those things, his father, played by Jack Nicholson, is experiencing kind of very extreme cabin fever and begins to become insane and obsessed with the history of the hotel, which leads in culminating in a kind of famous breakdown, you know, showing a cabin fever that leads to the Here's Johnny moment. I would say that actually it's, whilst his insanity is caused by isolationism, a lot of it is about kind of the opposite, you know, the fact that you've got this, that perhaps they're fine on their own, and it's the intruding powers that are the problems. It's the things coming in from the outside, the visions and the creatures and the, perhaps, you know, these little things that you know, and Scatman Carter's character and stuff like that. It's more about, I think, the way that the outside forces affect them more than them being, you know, being isolated. I don't know how to describe it, but yeah, I mean, just wonderful, terrifying, beautiful. Some of the best performances in any horror film ever from both the two leads. Yeah, just, you know, one of the best horror films of all time, if not the best horror film of all time. Next up, Suspiria. Now, this is the 1977 original, not the Luca, I can't remember how to pronounce his last name, the guy that directed Bones and All, and what's that film with Armie Hammer? And
what's the one? Call by Your Name.
Call by Your Name. Luke Goodgerdine. I can't remember him. It's not his remake, which I've heard praised an awful lot by people I follow on Twitter. But this is the Dario Argento Giallo classic, starring Jessica Harper. And this is a film that I've heard very much built up as kind of some of the greatest Italian horror, and the kind of Giallo kind of jewel in the crown. It's set around a woman that attends a dance academy, but you can start to feel very early on that there is something behind the scenes that is kind of more than it seems. There is some nefarious background goings on, and you know, more things start to come in as deaths and disappearances and such. And I feel embarrassed to say that I really, really did not like it. For all of the praise that it's got, for all of the historical importance of it, I really struggle with that. I mean, the fact that even though it's not really the fault of the film, the fact that the dialogue is all dubbed on in post, I really felt it made me disconnect from the characters. I really struggled, you know, on my own level. Perhaps that's more a problem with me. But I thought that some of the dialogue was pretty ridiculous itself. I thought that the plot was far too fastly paced, too quickly paced. I never felt like I got enough of a feel for each individual setting or character. And I think that kind of what ends up happening towards the end, the plot reveal, there is so little build up, so much exposition, so little actual build up, that everything that happens towards the end and all of the big reveals and the supernatural stuff seems ridiculous to me. I'd like to try, and because I think there are so many good concepts in here, I would like to give the remake a go. I know it's a lot longer, so maybe we'll get a bit more time, you know, feeling out the characters and understanding the environment a little bit more. But for me, I really struggled with Suspiria, and I came out of the cinema thinking, well, I then finished that film thinking very negatively of it. And we'll not deny, sounded beautiful, looked beautiful. We'll not deny the usage of primary colours in that is marvellous. And the final film I saw was The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the 1974 original. Now, I have seen Halloween, of course. I'm talking about Halloween Ends today. I've seen Scream, but I hadn't seen The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I've seen Nightmare on Elm Street as well. I had not seen The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which is kind of the one that started all off. I understand that Black Christmas predates this, but the big kind of slasher kind of massive franchises, it was the one that I was missing. But it's one of the films I've always heard, I don't know, from people that I've talked to, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre isn't actually that good. It's more just influential, and it's kind of more important because of the place it has in history. So I kind of came in with fairly low expectations, really, because I was thinking, okay, I'm going to understand the importance of this as a slasher genre, and I love slashers, and this is just going to kind of be a kind of history lesson. But I was actually shocked at just how much I loved it. I mean, it's just a wonderful film, I thought. Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a story of, very much as it describes in the title, a massacre with chainsaws, after a group of friends, young friends, go out for a road trip. They have to deal with a particularly annoying and an insane hitchhiker. They have to deal with kind of a small town atmosphere they're not used to, and then they have to deal with a man with a chainsaw going after and trying to kill them. Marilyn Burns plays the lead, famous for just the amount of screaming in it, and it's very intensive on the ears. But when it comes to the way it looked on the eyes, it has a very classic feel that actually made me appreciate Ty West's X more, because I realised just how much of a pastiche it is on this. But, you know, the grain and the feel is so timely. And the story was engaging. I think that it was paced in the appropriate level for a slasher. And I guess at this point, it was important to try and set the narrative for what that kind of feeling, because at the time, they might have not known that you can't make a 3-hour slasher. Yeah, it went very quickly, was very engaging. I was actually genuinely surprised about some of the plot points. And towards the end, I did not expect the situation to happen as it is. Maybe I'm a fool for not having heard that already. But yeah, I was really entertained. I thought that the violence, you know, is not on the same level you'd expect from modern day slashers, because, you know, this isn't the point where you just have to just push everything to the limit to shock people. But yeah, I very much enjoyed it. Again, it's a prototype, but I think itself was brilliant. Actually, one of the best slashers I've ever seen. However, you know, it's basically like if Halloween involved everyone just walking one after another into Michael Myers' house. But yeah. I've also seen a couple more horror films, but I feel like I've talked for so long that I'm going to let you have the mic for a bit, and then I'll come back and finish it off.
Yeah, so I've actually watched quite a few horror films recently, like not even in the build to Halloween. I watched Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2 with a friend. That was quite fun. That was just after Doctor Strange came out, so it made me appreciate the Sam Raimi early days vibes that kind of, you know, at least somewhat got translated into the MCU with Doctor Strange, and that was really fun. Also fun to like hear about the history of the second film and how it was basically just a redo of the first film, because apparently Sam Raimi lost the rights to the characters in the film, so he had to like remake the film pretty much.
Yeah.
Which was fun. But yeah, that was really fun, and like the practical effects and like the camera work and stuff, typical Sam Raimi, was really good. Also, I've seen recently, like horror wise, I've seen quite a few things that you guys would have covered on the podcast. The Woman King. I'm not sure if you saw See How They Run.
No, how was See How They Run?
You didn't see it.
No, I didn't, and we haven't reviewed it on the podcast. So give us something. So give us some breaking news. How good is See How They Run?
So yeah, See How They Run. I went into it. I was really looking forward to seeing it, because I love like whodunits. You know, I think when I watched Knives Out, that really changed the game for me. Like that made me really appreciate the genre. I went, you know, like Clue and those sort of films as well. Like that kind of whodunit genre. I think Knives Out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the problem now, is that with the Knives Out sequel coming up, everything has to compete with that film. And I think, like, it's hard to top that film. I think it's going to be hard for a whodunit to come out and really shock you and surprise you and, you know, kind of to top that film. But I think See How They Run as it was, like, for on its own merit. I really enjoyed the chemistry and the kind of characters of Sam Rockwell and Saoirse Ronan. I'd love to see, I don't think it would ever happen, but I'd love to see another film with those two. And kind of developing their like chemistry and relationship that they sort of establish and sort of develop through the course of that film. I mean, the actual mystery itself, it kind of felt very old, in a good way. It kind of felt very like old time Agatha Christie, where it's like, yeah, okay, like the big reveal is kind of a bit ridiculous, and well, not ridiculous, but it's kind of just like it just kind of comes out of nowhere with like, you know, one final piece where it's like it just happens, and then yeah. It felt very like old Sherlock Holmes book, where it kind of half of it is just nothing happening, and then half of it is just some character or some event or one random piece of evidence that kind of like then just, you know, comes out of nowhere and solves the case and saves the day kind of thing. So the actual mystery was, the mystery itself was intriguing. Like the way it kind of unraveled wasn't particularly, you know, as I say, it wasn't like Knives Out level of like intricate plotting and, you know, revolutionary. in that regard. But I did really like the characters of Rockwell and Ronan, and I'd love to see those in another film together. And yeah, I also, like I said, I saw The Thing. I saw Poltergeist as well yesterday, which I thought I hadn't seen, and it turns out I probably have seen it because I remember quite a few of the sort of major plot points. But I don't
also remember... directed by Tobe Hooper of Texas Chainsaw Massacre fame, of course.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not actually sure when I would have seen it though, because I mean, it was rated a 15. I'm not sure exactly. It felt very like family drama. Like, it didn't feel like a horror film. It felt like E.T. Right. mixed with Labyrinth. It felt very like.
Right. Wow, that is a damning. That's a damning insult in my book.
No, it didn't feel like a horror film though. Like, it had horror in it. I mean, in that regard, I guess I think about it though. Evil Dead doesn't really feel like a true horror film. It's kind of like goofy.
Yeah, Evil Dead is supposed to be goofy though. Isn't
it? Yeah, like goofy, campy horror rather than horror, scary horror. Yeah, I guess. But yeah,
I didn't imagine Poltergeist was goofy, campy horror though.
You didn't think it would be?
No.
I always thought Poltergeist. Well, because you've got the image of like the TV and stuff. I always figured it would be something along the lines of like Ring or Paranormal Activity or something.
Yeah, me too. I haven't seen it, of course.
But I mean, it is produced by Spielberg, and from what I was reading after I came home from the cinema, was that Spielberg did a lot of the storyboarding and post-production, and a lot of the cast have said that Tobe Hooper didn't really do that much in terms of like direction and post-production.
Right.
So it's kind of a Spielberg film in essence, but not by name. And that definitely comes across in terms of like, I've not even seen E.T., but from what I have seen of clips and stuff, it's like, it feels very much like it's the family focus is the kind of the core, and then it has like, you know, the extra terrestrial or the big sci-fi kind of slash horror slash whatever component as like the backdrop, but actually it's really a family film, and it kind of has like social or whatever themes or like commentaries that you can kind of attach to it, but it's not really a big like focus of the film, like at least obviously. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was good fun. It was I went into it like the first scene happened and I'm like, oh no, this is gonna be really scary film, and then I realized like 20 minutes in, oh yeah, this is not that scary. This is not like a horror, like a scary horror film, is it? It's like but no, it was good fun though. And I think I had seen it at least in part before. But yeah, like I say, I've seen like quite a few horror films actually. Not even just for that, but yeah, they're kind of like the recent standout highlights, I'd say, that are worth talking about.
Okay, yeah. I just a bit of moaning. I'm annoyed at myself for being desensitized. Because I still get grossed out. Like, when I watch even watch Mad God, there are scenes in Mad God that are really hard to sit through where I kind of visibly cringed. And I think there are a few scenes in Texas Chainsaw Massacre and stuff where I might have struggled a little bit visually.
Yeah.
But I don't think I've been scared by a horror film in quite a while now. And it's just something I wish I had. It's just because, you watch enough. And I'm sure there are definitely things out there that will do that. And we talk a little bit about it in the episode that's going to come out in a few days. But, you know, when Terrifier 2, a lot of people talk about it being so scary. But it does seem kind of gore-based. And, like, there are... I'm not, you know, desensitized to gore. You know, some of the films in the French Extremity, such as In My Skin, really did do me in. But, like, being actually terrified like I was the first time I saw It in the cinema, like, I just wish that I had that again. You know, something that I feel like I'm kind of losing a little bit. The only thing that's kind of managed to really shock me is kind of psychedelic horror, like In the Earth or Lux Eterna, where that, you know, again, Lux Eterna, not even a horror film, but that psychedelic sequence, for anyone that's seen it, that really kind of did me in, and I was shocked. I must have come out of the cinema shaking a bit. And In the Earth, a film that we both love a lot, that, you know, that really kind of left me kind of a little bit scarred when I came to the cinema because of the psychedelic nature. I think it's a bit of a shame. And I guess it's because I'm not desensitized to that. It's kind of unique or fairly uncommon in modern horror. So, yeah, I just wish I got more easily scared these days.
Yeah, I'm the same kind of. I think the last film that really kind of had a moment in it where I kind of had a visible, like, notable reaction in a horror... I say horror. It's not even a horror film, but... I think it would be Titan. There's a couple of moments in Titan where,
yeah,
but I think that was partly down to like the shock factor of not knowing. Well,
that's more like body horror, isn't it? Like gore,
yeah, exactly,
really,
yeah,
than terrifying, isn't it? Because like, I remember when I was watching it the first time, and I was thinking, oh, please don't do that, please don't go in there, please don't do this, oh, I just don't want us to end it, can you just be calm, oh, yeah, wake me up when it's, you know. I remember thinking that, and it's like, the final two films I want to talk about are related to today's subject. I watched so I've already seen, of course, Halloween 2018, 1977 one, and then I've seen Halloween Kills and Halloween Ends. But I haven't seen any of the original sequels, or I haven't seen the Rob Zombie ones, or I hadn't seen the H2O spin-off kind of ones. So I went out and I watched two films. I watched Halloween 2, the original Halloween 2 from 1981, which is a very much a direct sequel to the original. And I watched Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, which is not at all a direct sequel. So I did it last year when we did Halloween before. We did Halloween and Halloween 2018 and Halloween Kills with Brandon. And I went through the Halloween franchise. I'd just like to explain it again, just in case anyone doesn't know, because I love to explain the Halloween franchise. Are you aware of just how messed up the Halloween franchise is?
Am I aware of what, sorry?
How messed up the timelines of the
franchise. I know it's like three or four timelines, and there's one of like,
yeah,
Michael being siblings and various other, yes, shenanigans. Yeah.
So Halloween comes out in 1977. So Halloween is a film from 1977. Halloween 2, funny enough, is a sequel to Halloween. Halloween 3 is not a sequel to either of the first two.
Yeah.
It's completely unrelated and even features the first film on a TV as a fictional film. Halloween 4 is a sequel to Halloween 2. Halloween 5 is a sequel to Halloween 4. Halloween, The Curse of Michael Myers is a sequel to Halloween 5. So all so far, fairly simple, except for the fact that there's one film which is completely unrelated. Then Halloween H20, 20 years later, is a sequel to just Halloween 1 and 2, not Halloween 3, 4, 5 or 6.
Yeah.
Then Halloween Resurrection is a sequel to Halloween H2O, so it's a different timeline. Then Rob Zombie makes Halloween, which is completely unrelated, so it's another film just called Halloween, and then a sequel to that, Halloween 2. Then they make a third film that's called Halloween, and then that is just a sequel to the first one, not a sequel to the first two, like H20 was, just a sequel to the first one, and then Halloween, that's David Gordon Green's remake, 2018. Mm-hmm. Halloween Kills and Halloween Ends are direct sequels to that. The key, as you alluded to, the key reason why H20 is a sequel to the first two and Halloween 2018 is just a sequel to the first one is in Halloween 2, they established that Michael is actually brothers with Laurie, Jamie Lee Curtis's character. But then in the original, they don't mention that. So they decided with this new trilogy to not have them be siblings. So it's just as equal to the first one. So it's a very fucked up franchise of 11 films. So I went and watched Halloween 2 and 3. So Halloween 2 is very much a direct sequel to the first Halloween. It picks up, it's all set in the same night as the first film. And it's definitely one that, I mean, that if you look at any, if you go on Letterboxd and like write in Halloween on lists and look at people's rankings, if you go on Twitter and see people posting Halloween rankings, they are mad. There is no consistency. Halloween, mm-hmm, the first one, is within the first two films. Halloween Resurrection is in the bottom two films. Everything between that is a complete random. Yeah. No, you'll never guess what people are going to do. Because some people put Rob Zombie's Halloweens at like number one. Some people put them like bottom. There's no consistency. There's no consensus. So Halloween 2, though, which is the sequel, the first one, is very much towards the higher tier of most people's lists. So I had a lot of faith, hype coming to it because I love Halloween, the original. I love it. One of my favorite slashers. So I was like, Halloween 2, much the same cast, different director, same cast, only a few years later. It'll be good. And it's okay. It's really actually quite disappointing, I think. You know, stuff like the kills are better, you know, like, there's a lot more murder, which is obviously what they always ramp up in sequels to try and, you know, in exchange for story. But I didn't really feel like it added very much. And I wasn't particularly, you know, I think that there was no interesting kind of turn to the plot. There's nothing new to it. I was just a little bit for like, okay, I'm watching a kind of compilation of people getting killed here. Yeah, I mean, it really, you know, it's set in a hospital, this one, but I wasn't really all over it, to be honest. I thought it was fine. Halloween 3 Season of the Witch, another one that is, this one is, you know, the personification of that lack of consensus, because a lot of people think it's the best horror Halloween film. A lot of people think it's awful. I had a really good time with it, actually. I really enjoyed Halloween 3 Season of the Witch. It's a kind of, it seems like an oxymoron to describe it as a corporate folk horror. It's like, it's set in like, it's kind of that typical folk horror thing of like set in a little village of everyone's on the know, and every time a stranger walks in, everyone stares at them, and it's all like kind of that kind of thing that you know, typical folk horror. But then it's also set around a company town, and Silver Shamrock, a company that makes Halloween masks, that kind of run that town. And it's set around a man named Daniel Chalice, who's played by Tom Atkins, and his kind of accomplice and love interest, Ellie, who's played by Stacey Nelkin. And it's them two kind of poking around the town and trying to kind of go for the mystery of what's going on, and what's the real reason, and what's the supernatural reason behind you know, a series of strange deaths that are being occurring in their city that they live in, including the father of Ellie. Yeah, I mean, it takes some very strange turns, and it's kind of campy at points. But I actually thought it was very entertaining. I think that you say it's very 80s, but I think it was genuinely very entertaining. It was, you know, I actually kind of wish that Halloween had decided to turn into an anthology series at this point around different Halloween-based horrors, rather than just becoming a series of, you know, Michael killing, Michael killing, Michael killing. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. But I will say that I've never seen a more uncomfortable and inappropriate almost couple than the two in here. They have no chemistry. It feels wrong. It looks wrong. Very strange decision for them two to be together. But yeah, I actually would really recommend it. And I think it, yeah, more, one of the more entertaining films of the series that I've seen. Okay. I think that's pretty much everything that I want to talk about. When it comes to news, again, we recorded these episodes out of sync. So I don't really want to talk about much news, because we talked about more news on the last episode. I will say a disclaimer for the next episode when it comes out. We talk about the BBC Disney deal for Doctor Who, and how it's only a distribution deal, not a co-production deal, because that was the news that reported at the time. Since that came out, I think in the hour after we recorded that, we found out that it actually is a co-production deal to some degree, but Rusty Davis will be still maintaining main creative control. So it just means that they're going to give them a lot, basically Disney going to give Doctor Who high budgets, which is always a good thing. It's just annoying if they kind of get too Marvel-y around it. Okay, talking of Marvel, I've got a few Marvel things to talk about. So firstly is that Yahya Abdul-Mateen is going to be leading the Wonder Man series that they're starting, which is a good thing, because Yahya Abdul-Mateen is a wonderful, wonderful actor. But I also want to talk about this new spin-off that's been announced today, or might have been yesterday, which is Vision Quest, which is going to be starring Paul Bettany, of course, and is looking at the White Vision from WandaVision, as he kind of tries to regain his memories and emotions, and trying to basically find out why he isn't like the old Vision, and trying to become the old Vision. So this is the second spin-off of WandaVision that's been in production, along with Agatha Coven of Chaos, formerly House of Harkness. Vision, again, a character that perhaps might be a little bit strange to have their own series, seeing as they kind of are lacking in emotion. But how do you feel about this? Are you excited
for Vision Quest?
For Vision Quest,
I'm intrigued, because I mean, I was really excited for WandaVision when they announced it, like, you know, in the years leading up to WandaVision. And I remember people being like, oh, WandaVision, like, what the hell is that? Like, what's going to be rubbish? And then WandaVision was amazing. I don't know what they're going to do with Vision Quest. Like, how are they going to make that interesting? If it, is it just going to be a straight up, like, if his voice is of a tin of Vision, White Vision, trying to regain his, like, consciousness and memories and stuff. Like,
yeah,
they need to make it fun and exciting and not just, like, really boring. I don't, like, they need to do something, maybe not as radical as WandaVision, but do something, you know. We seem like with She-Hulk, they kind of went down like a comedy legal drama route, and like WandaVision, they did the kind of sitcom break the mold kind of thing. And I think if they did, if they make, do something that's a bit different, and then it might work. But I don't know. I've kind of getting to the point with Marvel as well. I think Lewis and maybe you hit this point like last year. Well, I'm just a bit like, I don't know how to feel about half the stuff I watch. I'm like, is this good? Is this bad? Is this just all right? Like, I watch.
Yeah, actually, I was literally going to ask you about Marvel fatigue. Yeah, I mean, I'm far, far behind the level of fatigue that Lewis is at. It's got to the point now where he's not reviewing any Marvel films for us anymore, except for Black Panther 2. Because I just don't, because he just doesn't care. He hasn't got an opinion on it, really.
Yeah.
So, you know, but I'm still at the point where I'm willing to give them a go. And I even though I have a problem with them in theory, I still enjoy quite a lot of the things they create. Mm-hmm. But I am getting to the point now where I'm losing interest, or I'm getting a little bit bogged down. Because once in a while, something comes out like Moon Knight, where it's different and it's exciting and it was worth watching, and I was like, okay, this is kind of regained my love a little bit for Marvel. But then when you see things like the Ant-Man trailer, and I'm just like, why am I putting myself through this, man? Like, even though I gave it a positive view and I enjoyed it at the time, stuff like Love and Thunder, it's just like, it doesn't inspire excitement in me anymore.
Yeah, I mean, Black Panther, I'm looking forward to Black Panther. I am very excited. Yeah, actually too, that's the massively. One thing that I would say I'm like very, very hyped for.
Yes.
On the upcoming slate. Loki season 2 actually as well. But that's like a little way off yet. But yeah, there's like, I don't know. I was speaking to like a friend about this the other day, and I was saying to them, like, I kind of like what they're doing. Like, everyone's talking about like Marvel fatigue and there's too much stuff coming out and it's all the same, and you know, people are watching it just because they're invested in the universe and they don't think it's that good, but they kind of just stick with it. And I kind of agree to some extent, a little bit more than I used to, but also part of me is kind of thinking, I quite like what they're doing, because at least at the moment with the current phases, like everyone says, oh, since Endgame, like there's no stakes and like there's nothing interesting to look forward to, and you know, Endgame should have been the end and that sort of argument, which I don't really agree with, because what I quite like about the MCU now, at least, is you don't, it feels like you don't have to, even as much as Disney would like you to, you know, buy Disney Plus and go to cinema every 3 months, it feels like you don't have to watch everything anymore to understand everything. Like, to understand Endgame, you had to have, you know, seen like Iron Man and Captain America, and you didn't have to, but like, it kind of felt like an obligation, and you kind of did need to watch quite a few films to understand.
Yeah.
Whereas now it almost feels like you kind of, it almost feels like it goes back to the kind of comic book kind of model of, you can kind of pick and choose what you want to watch, and it doesn't matter too much. Like, to watch, you know, Secret Wars, you aren't going to need to have seen like Miss Marvel or She-Hulk or, you know, Love and Thunder. Yeah. Like, you can kind of just pick and choose. You know, I like Spider-Man, so I'm going to watch the Spider-Man films, and I like The Supernatural, so I'm going to watch Werewolf by Night and Moon Knight, but I'm not bothered about Ironheart or Armor Wars because the Iron Man side of things doesn't interest me. Like, I kind of like that, the kind of pick and choose model that maybe Disney don't necessarily actively say they're doing, but they kind of are doing. Like, you remember when they said you don't need to have watched Disney Plus stuff to understand the shows or whatever, the movies or whatever?
Yeah, but then that wasn't true because Doctor Strange 2 was a sequel to WandaVision.
Well, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Doctor Strange.
And they kind of, you kind of did need to, but you didn't need to. But I feel like going forward from this point, at least, it definitely
just
feels,
I think,
like
the weird thing about Marvel fatigue for me is that I think the only thing that they've done in Phase 4 that I didn't like like straight up thought was bad was Eternals. Everything else I've thought was at least good, or at least like average. You know, like I've not thought anything was shit. Like I haven't seen all of it. Like I haven't seen a few of the shows. I haven't seen like four of the shows. But everything I've watched, I did enjoy, except for Eternals. But I still do feel that fatigue. So I think it's just, for me, I think it's just about output, really. Like I think it's just, it's getting a little bit too much. Like there is a film coming out, there's a TV show coming out every week, and a film coming out every 2 weeks. And it just feels a little bit like, yeah, you know, I kind of wish they slowed down a little. But we have to move on. I also say that Lupita Nyong'o has been, who's, you know, wonderful, wonderful, always wonderful, has been cast in Day One, which is a spin-off of the Quiet Place franchise, which I'm a big fan of. Yep. So, you know, good stuff.
Speaking of, just while we're on Marvel actors, you know, yep, and Marvel in general,
yep,
I'm not sure if you saw, but Joe Locke from Heartstopper has been cast in the Agatha Coven of Chaos series.
Oh, yes, I did see that, actually. Yes. I forgot to mention it.
But yeah, I haven't seen Heartstopper yet. I've heard it's very good, so I will have to get on to watching that.
But I do need to watch it because of Jasmine Finney is in Doctor Who, so I need to watch Sex Education and Heartstopper to prepare me for the new series Doctor Who. It's coming out next year. Okay, Sex Education for Tutti Gower, of course. Let's talk about Halloween Ends. Now, I think we actually will do a spoiler section for this one because there are quite, I think, a few things to talk about that. I think actually a lot of this we want to be in spoilers. So, before I go into my description of what the film is and me on your reviews, I will ask. So, I don't actually think I've ever talked about Halloween at all, really. So, last year on Halloween, we reviewed Halloween, the original, the 2018 remake, and Halloween Kills. Now, I want to know what you think of David Gordon Green's Halloween trilogy up till now. So what do you think of the 2018 Halloween remake? What do you think of Halloween Kills? Do you have positive opinions of them? Because if anyone, you know, wants to go back and hear my thoughts in full, then of course they can do that. But in essentially, I thought that Halloween, the 2018 remake, was a reboot, was a really interesting way to look at it. And I think the way it, you know, the whole meme about how Jamie Lee Curtis kept talking about it being about trauma very much is about trauma. I think it was a very respectful, very much darker, much more kind of emotional look at the effect of the events of the original. And I think that the slasher elements were strong, but I think that the emotional core of the film was really what held it up. And I actually felt that Halloween Kills completely abandoning the emotional drive in replacing it with just a kill fest was actually made it a far worse film. And I thought that Halloween Kills let me down massively and wasn't, well, you know, what I wanted going in. I wanted more kind of narrative and plot led horror rather than just a death fest, which maybe, you know, I was given, and maybe, you know, a lot of fans enjoyed, but for me, I thought you know, I was expecting a lot more, so I was let down by Kills. So that was my thoughts. What did you think of Halloween and Halloween Kills?
Yeah, so Halloween 2018, I mean, I watched the original Halloween and 2018 in like the day or two before Halloween Kills came out, and Halloween,
me too.
Say again, sorry.
You said me too.
Yeah, and Halloween, so the original was amazing, was great, and then the 2018 reboot I really, really liked. I thought for a reboot that came out, you know, what, 40 years or whatever after the original, to a really, really loved original horror film that had, you know, as you mentioned earlier, this reputation with really bad sequels and kind of all, you know, various unsuccessful timelines that didn't do particularly well, at least critically. And then, yeah, I thought the 2018 reboot was really, really good, and I really liked some of the imagery and parallels that were done in that film. Especially there's like that one scene where I've forgotten the character's name now, but Laurie's granddaughter looks out of the window in the school, and in the original film it's Laurie looking at Michael, but in that film it's her looking at Laurie. And I thought that some of the imagery and the parallels and the callbacks were really, really clever and interesting. And yeah, I thought that was a really good reboot and a solid film, you know, despite its flaws. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, Halloween Kills I thought was very, very bad. Like it has its pros, and I think when I first watched that film, there was the stuff that stood out to me most as like positives was like the cinematography and stuff. I thought visually it was very good. But then as someone pointed out afterwards, and it kind of made me sort of reconsider, was people talking about how it felt too clean and digital, and it felt very modern and like very against the grain of the original film. And it was supposed to be kind of dirty and grimy and not very, you know, the Halloween Kills, like for a modern audience, it looks great, but it kind of betrays the kind of origins of the franchise.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think Halloween Kills, like the plot itself was just ludicrous. Some of the things that happened in that film, I just thought, what is going on? By the end of the film, I just thought, like, Halloween Ends has to redeem it. It has to, like, do something to justify what's happened in this film. It felt like a filler. It felt very much like, we've got a trilogy, we've probably got an end in mind, we've got a beginning, how do we fill in the middle?
And we'll find out whether you think it redeemed itself in a minute. We'll find out whether this film is of the same level as of Halloween Kills, or whether it's somewhere between. Halloween Ends, picks up 4 years after the first two films. Halloween and Halloween Kills were set on the same night. This picks up 4 years later, and with Michael injured and in hiding, and Jamie Lee Curtis's Laurie moving on and trying to look beyond the fear that has dominated her life, the plot turns to another character, Corey Cunningham, played by Rowan Campbell, who is a teenage or a 20-year-old babysitter who accidentally kills a child that he is looking after, and is treated by the townspeople of Haddonfield as a murderer. And this film looks at maybe how he reacts to that and how that affects him, whilst the kind of eternal battle of Laurie and Michael starts to slowly bubble up once more. This has some connections to other films I've reviewed today, because the obvious one is The Thing, because Halloween was directed by John Carpenter, and The Thing was directed by John Carpenter. And in the original Halloween, they're watching the 1931 The Thing. Is it 1931? Whatever, 1930s film, The Thing. And then is it 30s or 50s? I feel like I'm getting that drastically wrong. I said 30s earlier. I think that the original thing is the 50s, actually, isn't it? Let me go check this out. Anyway, they're watching the original thing in the on the TV during Halloween, and then in this new Halloween Ends, they're watching the 1982 thing on the TV. So it's like got a little bit of a connection. And the other connection is that the other connection is that this is the 1951, not 1931. This is directed by David Gordon Green, a reboot by David Gordon Green, who's also directing a reboot of The Exorcist, which is coming out in 2 years' time, I believe. So I guess we can kind of see how well he's handled the trilogy and whether that's a good omen for the fans of The Exorcist when that film comes out next year or the year after. So, Halloween Ends. I'll go first. This film has had real mixed feelings. Initially, a wave of negativity during test screenings seemed to be made by some positivity when it first released, but now it's starting to, you know, have had more negative reviews than positive reviews on sites like IMDb and Letterboxd, who's got generally negative reviews. So, I think that if this came out after Halloween in 2018, I probably would have hated it, but my expectations definitely were readjusted by Halloween Kills. So I went into this assuming it was going to be a very dumb, kill-heavy, action-heavy slasher that didn't try and match the emotional core of the 2018 Halloween. So I was already kind of expecting less. And I don't think I did find something that was laden with emotion. I don't think I found something that was, very well written and emotional and allegorical and trauma-led. But I also wasn't felt something that felt as unnecessary, over the top, unserious, kind of ridiculous as Kills. Now, if we rated films purely on screenplay, Halloween Ends would be one of the lowest films I've reviewed in the podcast, because I won't pretend that the screenplay is anything but awful. The screenplay is dreadful. But yet the emotion, the acting, the plot, the action, the music, the visuals, I all felt led to a generally very enjoyable experience. I think a lot of people have criticized the lack of Michael in the film. But I think, if anything, Halloween Kills suffered from a problem of too much Michael. There's something much more interesting about a killer in the shadows than there is going to be about a killer that's popping out every 2 minutes. The mystique and the mystery and the obscurity of Michael is what drives him to be kind of so iconic and terrifying, rather than just constantly him stabbing one person after another. I think the decision was good. I think ultimately I felt closure. I had closure. The film gave me closure for all the plot points and all the stories that came along in the last 2-3 films, if you want to count the original. So I think ultimately left me feeling satisfied. There are definitely problems in this film. It is far from perfect. I mean, I won't pretend that it was anything near as good as the originals, this or the 2018 film. But ultimately, I had a very good time. I think the way that Corey's character perhaps felt a little bit too, maybe could have dealt with a little bit more build up to Corey's character. I think that even though we see a lot of him, kind of his motivations change very quickly, I think that the film would have done better having a little bit more of an emphasis on his motivations changing, why they change. I think everything happens a little bit too quickly. But I do think having him as a new character definitely freshened up the franchise. This kind of the problem with Kills, one of the problems with Kills, is that we just were thrown in 50 new side characters at once, expected to learn who they were, expected to know their names, and expected to care when they died and lived. This film only adds in one extra character, and it is one that I think does greatly enhance the plot, and is pretty much the main character here. I think worthy addition to the franchise, one of the only memorable characters that was added in, even Allison, who is the grandchild, which is featured heavily here, didn't seem to really be that important over the first two films. Supporting cast, I thought generally were pretty good. Will Patton was as good as always. I've never seen him be bad. Andy Matichak as Allison, thought she was pretty good. Flawed perhaps, but entertaining, big step up from the last one, and ultimately satisfying as a fan of the Halloween franchise for the closure it gave me. That's how I felt about it.
Nice. Just an interesting thing as well, I was just looking up actually while you were talking, because I'd only seen his stats, but I couldn't remember the exact figures for the screen time for Myers in the different films. I won't go through all of them, just because obviously this timeline is, as you mentioned, gets rid of like Halloween 2 and so on. But the original Halloween has 9 minutes and 37 seconds screen time for Myers. Right. Whereas Halloween 2018 has a screen time of 18 minutes and 30 seconds, so a double the screen time.
Really?
2018 versus the original. And then the screen time for Halloween Ends is 10 minutes 55 seconds. So it's only about a minute longer than the original film.
Which about Halloween Kills?
I don't know that one. I can find that one real quick. But
that one feels like it should be about 45 minutes.
Halloween Kills screen time.
Right, okay. We're just
yeah, I don't see it.
Yeah, I imagine that was higher, because it did feel as I said, I think too Michael heavy personally.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing as well, as you say, like, yeah, it's only a minute longer in Halloween Ends versus the original, but as you mentioned, the plot doesn't have as much focus on him, so it kind of makes sense. And if the film was as focused, it probably would have been about the same level as the reboots. But I think Halloween ends. I mean, as I said, Halloween Kills was very underwhelming and disappointing. And going into Halloween Ends, you have that kind of, you go with the mindset, okay, it's gonna be along the same vein. It's not gonna be very good. I actually quite liked Halloween Ends, and it's similar to the Batman, although to no extent the same amount. The more I've only seen it once, but I am tempted to revisit it, because the more I've thought about it, the more I do like the stuff it does try to say. I think it does actually try and say something quite interesting. It does have something to say on like Halloween Kills, which the one message it did have was absolutely absurd and ridiculous, given the like mob mentality of that film. I think Halloween Ends, yeah, though, I did actually really quite enjoy it. I think, as you mentioned, it introduces some new characters that, unlike Halloween Kills, actually serve a purpose to the plot and do actually do some interesting things. I think there was a couple of Halloween Ends that had a couple of things that I didn't enjoy as much as the other films in this new trilogy. I think the scores, the kind of remixed scores that had been done by the Carpenters, was definitely, I preferred the 2018 kind of modern aesthetic kind of take on the Halloween theme and the music, and also the Halloween Kills, which had the kind of more kind of orchestral choral rendition of the music. I think the
draw
music
us out. Just want to clean up that you mean the scores done by John Carpenter and Cody Carpenter, not by the band the Carpenters.
No, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Not from the 70s band, the Carpenters.
Yeah, no.
Continue.
But no, yeah, I did definitely prefer the music. The scores were definitely, I felt stronger in the first two installments. Likewise, I preferred the opening scenes from the first two films. I think the opening scene of this one was good, and I think part of the reason why it didn't have as much of an effect on me was because the fact that they kind of spoiled that opening scene in the plot description of the film. Like,
oh really? I didn't know that. I, for one, did not know that, and was shocked and very much like intrigued by the opening scene personally.
Well, yeah, but you know how like the plot description for the like the synopsis line of Halloween Kills.
Yeah, I mean, I did. I spoiled it.
Yeah.
In describing the film, when I talked about how the babysitter manslaughters the child.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So that was. It did shock me in a way though, because I was expecting it to be like Myers related, like he'd been framed, or like it looked like it was him, but it wasn't, or something. So that the way it happened kind of shocked me. But
well, to be fair, it is Myers related, because it's all in the shadow of Myers. The reason why he's scared, the reason why he
that's
up
true,
there,
that's
the reason
true.
Why
that
his
is
knife
true.
Is all on. It is kind of because of the trauma, collective trauma of Myers.
Yeah, that's true. But yeah, I did think Halloween Ends had some interesting things to say. As you mentioned, the character of Corey, it did feel like some of the developments in his like narrative arc were quite rushed. It did feel like there was like a joke. I'm not sure quite sure when it happened, but there was a point in the film where from one scene to the next there was just this kind of really distinct jump that wasn't really explained, or like it wasn't really developed. It kind of just came out of left field, and it kind of took me like a little period of time to kind of just adjust to that kind of development and kind of be like, okay, right, that's where they're going with the story then. But there were some like really cool, I thought this film had some, it's fair, so Halloween Kills had some quite cool moments too. I think the thing with Halloween Ends, I'm not sure if you would agree, but it kind of feels like with Halloween Kills, they didn't really know where they were going with the film, like with the trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost feels like Halloween Ends, like, I don't know if this is the case. I don't know how. Well, because didn't they film the two films pretty close together, right?
I'm unsure, to be honest.
But it feels like Halloween Ends, at least, like, the way it comes across when watching the two films. It feels like Halloween Ends is like, they released Halloween Kills, saw the reaction, and then kind of went, right, we need to do something. We need to, like, fix this trilogy.
Yeah. I mean, say you were unaware, say you just watched these three films, I think you would very much be under the impression that three directors did them. I think that the fact that this is David Gordon Green across all three films would be quite surprising, because I think they take very different there is not much that links them in terms of the attitude they go into to creating the film. I don't feel like the themes, the kind of way that it's produced, the style, all of it is very different from each one, which is one of the reasons why I think the answer is, do I feel confident about him creating an Exorcist film? My answer is, I have no idea, because I don't know if I'm going to get the Halloween Ends, the Halloween Kills, or the Halloween version of David Gordon Green, or the Pineapple Express version, going into the Exorcist, because they feel so different. I do agree with you that I think that if Halloween Kills did amazingly well, this would have been a lot more based around Michael Myers stabbing people.
Yeah. And also, wasn't there supposed, like, I remember the rumors last year that there was going to be like a COVID. Do you remember there was like news like that there's going to be a COVID related subplot or like some kind of COVID related thing, and that just wasn't in the film. So
yeah,
I'm glad he wasn't in the film, because that would have been disastrous probably.
Almost all COVID media has been received badly, or people haven't liked it, or almost all the COVID subplots people are getting like tired of. Yeah. I feel like the only film that has done any COVID-style subplot to a level I thought was okay was In the Earth.
Yeah, and even then it was nondescript and it didn't actually...
Exactly. I think that's why I think it worked, because it was nondescript. Yeah.
But
they did the COVID in this.
I think Halloween Ends, like, it's like, it has flaws for sure. Mm-hmm. Like the music, like even like the opening song that they played, and then like the way it kind of transitions into the film, it didn't feel like a Halloween film. It didn't feel like it was set in the right. When that started, I was a bit like, oh no, here we go. But it did find its feet. Even if it did feel like it was running too quickly with those feet at times, but it was, I think it definitely redeemed, at least in my eyes, it redeemed the trilogy back towards that level of Halloween 2018. It didn't quite reach the same quality, but I think at least Halloween Ends tried to do something and tried to say something, whereas Halloween Kills,
I think quite a lot rested on this, really, because if this was bad, you would just say Halloween was good, but the trilogy was shit.
Yeah.
But now you can say this was a pretty good trilogy. It had a bit of a flaw. It had a bit of a fall off in the middle, but it was overall a pretty good trilogy. It's definitely worth watching. And let's be honest here: most horror reboots and sequels and remakes are crap. So the fact is that you've got two out of three of them are good. That's more than you can say for most things. I mean, the Nightmare on Elm Street remake was awful. The Friday the 13th remake was awful. You know, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was awful. You know, so, you know, I guess it says a lot that at least two out of three are good. And even Halloween Kills, which is the worst, has not been critically received to the degree that those films were. So I guess that's a positive itself. So, but yeah.
I find it interesting as well, though, like Halloween Ends, like I look through on Letterboxd and it just has a majority of really bad ratings. And I just think,
I don't get it.
I don't see how you can go into, like, come out of that film and think that was a one-star film.
I do think that if Halloween Kills was good, people would have enjoyed this more. I think there's a lot of things that people came in here with low expectations. They were kind of looking for it to be bad.
Right.
Maybe that's unfair for me to say, but I do think that, you know, this film got a lot of hate piled on before it was even released, and I think people were looking for this to be bad. But I think a lot of the problem from horror fans is that there's not enough Michael. which I understand, but isn't what I'm looking for. I'm not just looking for death in this for me either. That's not what I'm looking for.
No.
And I think the people that maybe weren't horror fans maybe thought they kind of lacked a bit of the emotional side. So I think, you know, it's a bit of a jack of all trades, I think. And for me, that worked because I like a bit of both. But then maybe it didn't appeal to enough people. I will say this film had an awful release. This film should not have been coming out on the 15th of October. This film should be coming out the weekend of Halloween, week early at latest. The fact this was barely on, this was like one screening a day by the time Halloween came around. This film was not easy to watch a few days ago. You know, I had to go to a different cinema to watch this. Terrible release. In America, released same day streaming. Awful decision. As if they can't bring in people on Halloween night in America to watch a Halloween film.
The same day digital release was a bizarre decision. Like,
awful.
I don't know why they did
Look how well Smile's done. Look how well Terrified 2's doing. People still go to the cinema to see horror. It's one of the only things they do go to the cinema to see. So, yeah, awful decision. If you want to hear my thoughts on Smile, you can find out in the episode of the podcast that comes out in a few days. Because I was about to give it my thoughts on it, but I'm not going to. I just realised that hasn't come out yet.
Yeah.
But have you seen Smile?
I'm going to go see Smile and Barbarian this weekend.
Okay.
And I'm seeing Don't Worry Darling tonight for the first time, so.
Oh, really? Yeah. Me and Lewis really both enjoyed that film. Both gave very positive reviews on the podcast, which you can, you know, you can listen to that episode for, that's the last episode of the podcast from now, I think. Okay, so let's get into ratings. So what would you rate Halloween Ends out of 10?
It's a tough one, actually. I think my gut says like 7 out of 10, I think.
My gut says the exact same thing. I'm going for a big fat 7 out of 10.
Yeah.
Very fun.
7 knives.
Gave me closure. Screenplay was god-awful. I will say that. Screenplay was god-awful. And that's what holds it back from being higher. Dialogue especially did feel a little bit too... old person writing young person... doesn't always work, and it felt about that. Okay, what about your man of the match, though?
Well, actually, I was just going to say something then, but it's kind of related to man of the match, so I'll say it now. This isn't a man of the match, but I just want to say on a quick note, Jamie Lee Curtis had a phenomenal year. Like, her performances this year in this film, and also you can say somewhat in Halloween Kills as well, but also in Everything Everywhere All at Once, her performances have been... like awesome.
Yes.
And on a slightly tangent note as well, Shelley Duvall as well is coming back, right, for a film.
Yes.
So
that's good news. That's news I didn't even mention.
Yeah.
Yes. We're talking about all-time greatest scream queens. Jamie Lee Curtis is probably the GOAT scream queen because, you know, obviously she did The Fog and stuff as well. Shelley Duvall. Yeah. I mean, the industry famously mistreated her. You know, she was let down by the industry, and I feel happy that I think mainly fan base. I think, you know, she realised how many people just love her, so it's quite heartwarming to see her return, and I'll be very much looking forward to it. Of course, you know, it's a little bit you know, Brendan Fraser esque. You know, having his like kind of later career comeback that we're seeing right now with stuff like The Whale and would have been Batgirl.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, it's always nice to see. Yeah, and Casey Kwan, of course, who starred alongside Jamie Lee Curtis, is having a bit of a revival now.
But yeah.
Yes, so man of the match.
I'm going to go for, I don't know if you'll find this slightly questionable. I don't know, maybe you'll agree. I'm going to go for Rohan Campbell, who played Corey Cunningham.
Yeah.
I think I am too,
you know.
Say again, sorry.
I think I am going to go for Rohan Campbell myself.
Yeah, because...
We're both, wow, how boring. We both went for the same person and the same rating.
Like, he essentially leads the film. He's an unknown who I'd never seen anything, never heard of. And, you know, despite, as we talked about before, in terms of pacing and screenplay and the way in which the transition in character happens, I think he does sell that transition very, very well.
Right,
and you know, starting off as this kind of like almost like loser, like, you know, beaten on by Haddonfield's character, and then the way that he kind of like transitions into the later parts of the film, and obviously,
yeah,
you know, taking up that like kind of role in the film, I think he did do it really well, and yeah, that's why.
I mean, I think Halloween Kills is about mob mentality. Halloween Ends, to a degree, is also about mob mentality. The Kills treating with Michael and Ends with Corey Cunningham. And I think it just shows how much better Ends is because of it's such more. I think it's a far more entertaining, or far more not entertaining, far better written look at mob mentality and how it affects people and how necessarily unfair trial by media that was around this character. I think it's a much better example of it, and perhaps the scenes in the bar, you know, the way he gets treated in the bar, both when he's there and how they're talking about him later, some of the more interesting discussions in the film. So I think that, you know, he's a kind of a bit of a personification of why this film is so much better than its predecessor. I think it's the interesting spark that was thrown into this film. They needed something new, and I think Corey Cunningham was a very good addition. And I think portraying kind of the different sides of his character, you know, before the incident, after the incident, after he snaps, all those different versions of him, I think was done very well by Ryan Campbell. So I agree. I think he's my man match too.
Yeah.
This podcast is cursed, Jordan.
Why?
This podcast is cursed.
Well, that's because. But why?
Yeah. Because I have hot take after hot take, and Spencer, right? Spencer is a film that people liked. People thought that Kristen Stewart was good. I think one of the best films I've ever seen. Amazing, 10 out of 10. Kristen Stewart might be the best performance I've ever seen in my life, right? And I happen to do a podcast with the only person I've ever met that has the same opinion, right? And then, like, I have a super hot take about Top Gun Maverick, right, for example. And I was like, that film's a 2 out of 10. It sucks. It sucks ass, right? And I happen to do a podcast with the only cunt that thinks the same thing. So it's boring content, right? And, like, don't worry, darling. Everyone hated it. I loved it. Guess who I did the podcast with? Someone else that loved it, right? And now I even get someone else on. I get a different bloke on. And they think the same thing about me about Halloween Ends, which has been slaughtered by everyone. And the only other person that thinks it's a 7 out of 10 that Rowan Campbell is the man of the match happens to be the person I asked to do the podcast.
Yeah.
What is the chances? This podcast is cursed to have poor content. I need you to go out and say, Sam, you fucking idiot, you fucking asparagus, you twat.
Well,
there was a bit of an argument last week because I don't know if you, I'm assuming you didn't listen to the podcast last week. We reviewed Avatar because it got re-released.
Yeah.
And I dropped the bombshell that I left the cinema early because of how bored I was by Avatar.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And Lewis was not a fan of that. He was not a fan of that.
Lewis, for an anti-Disney MCU advocate, Lewis is very pro-Avatar.
He's a big fan.
He's a big fan.
No, I seemed to... Until about 2 months ago, I didn't think there was any big Avatar fans. But since it started like getting re-released and Way of the Water trailers and stuff, it seems like everyone's a massive Avatar fan. But I never, ever met them until this point. But yeah, I'm still looking forward to Way of the Water, of course. I think it looks great. But yeah, the original Avatar.
No, speaking of Avatar, though, I'm not sure if this is like news, but I just saw a tweet. I forgot to mention this during the news section earlier because it just popped up on my timeline when we were talking about the news. Avatar trailer comes out tomorrow. The new Avatar trailer. Yeah.
Okay. That's the 2nd of November.
So,
by the time you listen to this, it'll probably be out. That's intriguing. I tell you, the films coming out soon look great. Like, we're in a good period. Because I was in the cinema today watching Black Adam, which I can't talk about because we talk about it in the next episode. So even though I don't review it in the next episode, I will talk about it in the episode afterwards. So, because I don't want to have my... But anyway, when I was in so much of Black Adam, the trailers were like... I thought the Matilda musical looked all right, to be honest. Super Mario Bros. Movie looks really good. Like, unironically, looks really good. You know, Chris Pratt's accent aside. The Oppenheimer trailer again. I'm so excited for Oppenheimer. It's going to be amazing. Creed 3 looks really good. It's like... Almost all the trailer. I think like every trailer that played, I was like, "This looks good."
Yeah.
Like we're in a good place. Like I'm excited.
Yeah, I've had Babylon, Bones and All,
Babylon. Bones and All trailer looks really good. I'm really excited for it.
I tried to avoid the trailer, and I only found out the actual premise of the film, like, accidentally the other day. I kind of wish I didn't know it, but then I, having known what it was and then seeing the trailer, I was like, okay, at least I already knew what it was before I saw the trailer. Like, I didn't, like...
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, it's like, I've seen the trailer now, so it doesn't matter if I know what the film's about.
Yeah.
But no, there's some good films coming out soon.
Yeah.
For sure.
Including, of course, Black Panther, which comes out, like, in a week, week and a half time.
Yeah, I love
it. That comes around. That's one of the things about Marvel films coming out all the time, every week, is that they always sneak up on me really quickly because I still expect them to be 6 months apart. And then, like, I still feel like, oh, you know, Marvel just had a film out because, like, Thor. And then fucking, it's already next one's out. Like, and I was not expecting it. And now, it's already snuck up on me.
Have you seen Barbarian?
No, I've not, no.
Oh, okay.
I wanted to do it for this episode of the podcast, actually. But they just weren't showing it. They aren't showing it in Ely, and I'm in Ely right now. So,
because
I'm going to go on holiday, which is why I'm releasing all the podcasts and pre-recording them.
Yeah.
But yeah, so no, Barbarian. So you're seeing Barbarian this weekend, right?
This weekend, yeah. Same as Smile. So I'll let you know what I think.
Okay. Well, you can listen to my podcast, the podcast that's coming out in like 3 days, 4 days, for what I think on Smile. Or I could actually just tell you, because I do know you outside of the podcast. But anyway, let's don't ruin the facade. Okay. Well, thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast, Jordan. It's always nice to have you. Our old faithful podcast friend. We would not be here without you. We would not have reached 100 episodes. This is like 104th episode. We would not have reached 100 if we didn't have the first 30 or 40 with you. So, you're always welcome here. So tell the folks at home what your details are. How can we find you?
Yeah, so just Letterboxd and Twitter is by Jordan Luke. I need to update my Letterboxd. I'm missing like 6, 7, 8 things I need to put ratings on for, including Halloween Ends.
Yeah.
Which also I forgot to mention on a very, very final thing. I did quite enjoy the flashbacks in Halloween Ends. The use of flashbacks were quite powerful, I felt.
Me too. Yeah, me too.
While we're talking
and
about
if anything,
the
best part about Halloween Kills was the flashbacks. So.
Yeah, it was pretty good. Yeah. Also, yeah, that flashback as well, I didn't realise at the time. I was watching a YouTube reaction to Halloween Kills yesterday. I didn't realise that the Halloween Kills opening, which is like a flashback scene, well, the second part of the opening scene,
yeah,
the flashback, I didn't realise that that's... Obviously, it's like directly after the events of the original Halloween, but that's... Yeah. The reason they did that was because they were showing that this timeline retconned Halloween 2. Because it's like, it's supposed to be directly after the events of Halloween, the original Halloween.
Yeah. There's actually quite a few similarities between what they do and what they don't do, kind of thing. There are scenes that are similar in Halloween 2 to the flashback to Halloween Kills, but they are slightly different enough that you can realise that it's not connected yet. You just dropped your Letterboxd. Do you have Letterboxd Patron?
I've got Patron or whichever the highest tier is.
Yeah, Patron. Yeah, have you been enjoying the posters feature? Because I got Patron just for it. So good, isn't it?
And it finally came to Android. It took a while to come to Android, so I was having to do it on like browser. But I've updated.
Oh, of course. I did know. I saw your tweet about you changing your posters. I think it's your header, isn't it? You change your posters, your favorites, so that they kind of match up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very annoyed that I can't do that because my favourite film and my number one on my favourites is Baby Teeth. And because it's a small release, it literally has one poster on that fucking thing. Like, they're just different versions of the same poster. It just has, like, in different fonts.
Yeah.
So I can't do it. You've got more black and white in you. It looks cool. It looks very cool.
Yeah, it's very funky.
Yeah. Okay, so you can find the podcast, of course, on Twitter at Now Showing Podcast. No, you can't. I just lied to you. You've got it at NowShowingPod. And you can also get the podcast directly at NowShowingPod@gmail.com. You can find me on Letterboxd at Sam Houston and on Twitter at Sam H Media. If you like the podcast, the best thing you can do is to tell your friends about it. But you can also help out yourself by giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever else you consume us. Thank you very much for listening. You can see us next time, which is in the second episode of our week of podcasts, as we'll be releasing an episode on Smile, The Woman King, and Black Adam. Till next time, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Bye.